देवे पौर्वाणी प्रचारिणे निर्विशेष शून्यवादी पाश्चात्यदेश।
हरे कृष्ण। Welcome everyone to the first day of this seminar called The Essence of Bhagavad Gita. The seminar itself will span 3 days, starting with this evening, and then 2 sessions tomorrow, and then 1 session on Sunday, followed by the usual Sunday feast program. So today we're going to sort of make an introduction into the topic by discussing sort of the overall framework of Bhagavad Gita. Now, in my undergraduate years, I was a mathematics major, a philosophy major and a math major. And one of the things that mathematicians are always very eager to achieve is not just accuracy in their formulations. That's important, right? For formulas and for equations and things like that to be accurate, to get the right result. But they're also interested in how they get that result. Right? One more thing is important. Besides accuracy, anyone know what else mathematicians are interested in?
Conciseness?
Yeah, conciseness. And they put it in terms of eloquence. Something has to be eloquent or beautiful, not just accurate. So in other words, if I can do this formula, I can figure out this problem in 25 steps, that's good. But if you can figure it out in 10 steps, that's much better. It's not so much wasted effort. Right? Mathematicians are looking for eloquence, looking for conciseness. The same thing happens with grammarians, those who study grammar. In ancient India, Sanskrit is, in the school of Panini, there was a great teacher of grammar a couple thousand years ago. And it says that if a grammarian is able to save half of a syllable in a word, right, by saying something more concisely, then that's cause for a putrotsava, a festival as good as having a son, right? You celebrate having a child or having a son. That's the level of celebration they look forward to. Same thing goes with editors, right? If you've worked with an English editor or you've worked with an English teacher, they're constantly asking you to do tight editing, right? To make things concise, to make things shorter. And of course, that's become even more the case in our world today. We live in a bite-sized world where everything comes in little snippets, right? Little pieces. Yeah, Twitter-sized pieces. And if anything goes on for more than half a page, then most people, they don't bother reading it all the way to the bottom, or they just skim through it. Doing lengthy readings, listening to lengthy lectures, that's something that's very much a thing of the past. People want to know what the main points are. Right? And so bullets were invented, and your CVs and resumes, and so on, they show bullet points. Just recently, I was reading sort of updated advice on creating a resume. And not only were they saying, you know, don't do long paragraphs and have bullet points, but now they're saying, don't have too many bullet points, right? Just 4 or 5 is kind of enough, and then move on. Talk about it. Because the person who's going through your resume is not going to have more than a few minutes, a few seconds rather, to scan through your resume and then move on to the next one. So conciseness, or being brief, along with accuracy, both of these things are very important from ancient times, but also in our own time. In Chaitanya Charitamrita by Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami, he defines the word eloquence in a very beautiful way. This is Srila Prabhupada's translation. Very nice. He says, essential truth spoken concisely is true eloquence. A beautiful definition, if you think about it. Essential truth spoken concisely is true eloquence. And this has two sides to it, two parts to it. Essential truth spoken concisely. Okay. So first thing is, excuse me, we talked about how it has to be short. It has to be concise. But what you're presenting also has to be essential truth. It has to be something that everyone needs to know. It has to be something that is of the essence. So, in other words, Twitter would not count in this definition, right? Unless the person posting their message is going to be presenting something of utmost importance to human life, something that's of the essence. It's not just concise, but it has to be essential at the same time. Essential truth spoken concisely has to be true eloquence. Now, think about this. The world's largest repository of literature is found in which language? Anyone know? Sanskrit. Sanskrit. I'm talking about literature as in classical literature, not just the amount of material printed or published. That's a different concern. But in terms of literature, as in philosophical, literary, poetic writing, you look at ancient Greek, you look at ancient Latin, and then you look at ancient Sanskrit. There's tons and tons of material out there on every subject you can imagine. I once visited for my PhD, I was visiting different places in India to look for manuscripts, handwritten texts of works by Jiva Goswami, one of our acharyas, one of our predecessor teachers in the line of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And these are handwritten manuscripts before the days of printing, rather. And I visited one manuscript collection where it was a private collection by a Brahmin who had sort of put together everything he could gather on any subject. And he gave me a tour of his library. Amazing. He had something like 40 complete manuals, texts, on Gaja Chikitsa, which means medicine for elephants. How to cure elephants. 40 texts, ancient texts, medieval texts, modern texts, on that one topic. And hundreds of topics like this. This whole vast repository of knowledge we call Veda. The word Veda itself means knowledge. In fact, it comes from the Sanskrit root vid, which means to know. To know as in wisdom, right? To really see something, to know it. Which is the same word as the English word video, same cognate word, vid and video. It comes from the same root in Latin. So, any sort of knowledge, any sort of wisdom, okay, Veda, and it's vast. Just the Mahabharata, for example, 100,000 verses, the longest epic in the world. You look at just the works written by the Gaudiya Vaishnava Acharyas. The six Goswamis of Vrindavan wrote 1 million verses in Sanskrit together. 1 million verses. So, now we fast forward to our own time, and we think, okay, so where's the essence? Where's the essence? I don't have the time to read millions of verses. I don't have the time to read the entire Mahabharata. Who has? We've all seen the television serial, or we've all read little digests of it or something like that. So we know the story. But if you actually read the Mahabharata, very few people I've met have actually read the entire epic, what to speak of actually remembering what happened there. So who has the time to read all of this? And where is the essence? Where is the summary? And so we find that all of the great acharyas and teachers throughout ancient India, Sanskritists, in our own line, they've always tried to do their readers a favor by extracting what is most essential in just a few verses. So you have, for example, the four essential verses of Srimad Bhagavatam. It's called Chatushloki Bhagavatam, four essential verses. You have the four essential sutras of Vedanta Sutra, called Chatusutri Tika, the commentaries on these four sutras. And for Bhagavad Gita, you have the four essential verses of Bhagavad Gita, called Chatushloki Bhagavad Gita. So for any text, any work, they look for both things. How much, how big is it? How vast is that knowledge? How encyclopedic is it? And how can I find that entire encyclopedia in a tiny little space, in just a little space? So for example, one important place to look for the essential meaning is the opening verse. Nearly every acharya, nearly every commentator will give the heart of their entire teaching in just the opening verse, in just the first verse. For example, Srila Prabhupada's purports on Srimad Bhagavatam. His purport to 111, the first verse of the first chapter of Srimad Bhagavatam. You remember how long it is? It can be made into a little booklet. The entire philosophy of Krishna consciousness is present in that little, in that one verse. And that's not just Srila Prabhupada. Every acharya who comments on Bhagavatam puts all of it in the first verse. They're in their commentary. So in the same way, I'll give you one other example. The Ramayana. Ramayana is, again, a very large book. Not as much as Mahabharata, but it's still about 25,000 verses. That's still very, very large. I don't know how big the Homer's classics are, Iliad and the Odyssey. Anyone know? I think it's larger than both of those put together. So, the first verse of the Ramayana, the first verse ever spoken to the story of Lord Ram. This verse was spoken by Valmiki Muni when he was out one day with his disciples. You know this story? One day Valmiki Muni was going out with his disciples in the evening for a nice walk. And it was a beautiful scene. Everything was perfect. It was idyllic. The sun was just setting, and the birds were out, and the trees and the flowers and nice aromas, a cool breeze. And they were walking past a lake in which there were two birds, cranes. And they were in love with each other. They were in the process of showing affection to each other and mating in the water, with standing in the water. And it was just sort of perfect, right? It was like an ideal scene of the beauty of nature. And then all of a sudden, as he was observing this, an arrow whizzed past them. They didn't see who it was, but a hunter's arrow whizzed past them and hit and killed one of the birds. And it broke that idyllic scene just like that. And that bird died. And the other bird, its partner, saw what happened, shed tears, cried, fawned over the dead body of its mate, and out of pain also died soon after. So it was a horrible thing to see, right? From an idyllic scene to the raw cruelty of human beings and nature. So all of a sudden, Valmiki Muni, he felt a lot of anger. A lot of anger welled up in him. And without his even realizing it, right, a verse issued from his mouth, which took the form of a curse, of terrible curse. The verse goes like this. This is the first verse of the Ramayana, of the story. And the first verse, it says, that was ever composed. And it goes like this. Ma nishada pratishthantvam agama sashvati sama yat kroncha mithunad ekam avadhi kama mohitam. Ma nishada pratishthantvam. O nishada, O hunter. He hasn't seen the hunter. He's just guessing, right? O hunter, Nishada, ma pratishthantvam, may you not have any peace. May you not find any rest. Agama Shashwati Sama. For thousands and thousands of years, for eternity, he says. Agama Shashwati Sama. May you never find any peace anywhere. Why? Yat Kroncha Mithunat Ekam Avadhi. Because you killed one among the pair of birds. Avadhi Kama Mohitam. When they were bewildered, when they were enchanted by love. At that moment, the worst moment possible, you killed one of them. Therefore, may you not find peace anywhere. So Valmiki Muni, he was really very upset. And he went back. But as he was going home, he started thinking about what he had said. And he started feeling really, really bad inside, very regretful. Why did I get so angry all of a sudden? I'm a sage. I'm supposed to be able to control my anger. Who was this hunter? Maybe he was just trying to make a living. At least I should have been a little more gentle. No peace for any time. It's better that I should have killed him at least. Said, may you die immediately, like the birds you killed. But instead, I gave him eternal life with no peace. Okay, not eternal. Nothing in the world is, in the mature world is eternal. Right? But thousands of years of no peace. So he was feeling horrible inside, regretting it. When finally Lord Brahma appeared, he came to him and he told Valmiki, he said, my dear son, don't worry. The words that came to your mouth are not ordinary. Remember, think about what you said. So Valmiki Muni had one disciple who had a photographic memory and he recalled the verse immediately. And when they read the verse again, they recited it, they realized that all those words in that verse formed for the first time, that curse formed a verse, a meter, a rhythm to it, a shloka for the first time. Four quarters, each one 8 syllables long. Ma nishada pratishthanvam agama shashvati sama yat krauncha mithunad ekam avadhi kamamohitam. Right? 8 syllables times 4, 32 syllables altogether. This was the first shloka, the same verse size, the same meter in which the entire Ramayana is written, the entire Mahabharata is written, the entire Bhagavad Gita is written, most of Srimad Bhagavatam is written, and most of all Sanskrit literature. So therefore, Ramayana is called Adikavya, the first story, the first poetry ever spoken. And just historically speaking, it's a fact. It's one of the oldest stories and the most widespread stories in the history of the world. Now, here's the point. A very famous commentator on the Ramayana named Govinda Raja, he says, this is the first verse spoken in the Ramayana. So actually, the entire story of the Ramayana is present in this first verse. This was the point of eloquence. Finding the largest amount of material in the smallest space possible. That's eloquence. So he says the whole story is present in this one verse. And he explains it like this. It's actually very clever the way he does it. He says, Ma Nishada. Nishada means hunter. But Ma Nishada. Nishada also in Sanskrit means one who rests, one who sits down in a place. And Ma can refer to Lakshmi, who is the mother, Mata. So Ma Nishada means one who is the resting place of Lakshmi. So Ma Nishada means Srinivasa. Srinivasa, Sri means Lakshmi, Nivasa means resting place. So Ma Nishada means O Narayana, O Lord Vishnu, O Srinivasa. Pratishthantvam, may you be always famous. Pratishtha means fame. May you be always famous. Why? Yat krauncha mithunat ekam avadhi. Because you killed one amongst the pair. Krauncha mithuna. Krauncha means Ravana's Mandodaris, Ravana's wives, grandfather was named Kruncha. Kruncha was his name. So Kruncha refers to his descendants, namely Mandodari. So you killed one amongst the pair of Ravan and Mandodari, namely Ravana. Avadhi Kama Mohitam. Why? Because he was completely overcome by kama, or lust, for Sita. So may your fame be spread all over the world, because you killed Ravana. So the whole story, which was a curse, he finds in this, that same verse. And the whole story of the Ramayana is present there, the essence. So the same thing is true of Bhagavad Gita also. The essence of Bhagavad Gita can be found in several key verses, in key places. Look at the first verse of Bhagavad Gita. What's the very first word of Bhagavad Gita?
Dharma.
Dharma. Dharma kshetre kurukshetre samaveta yuyutava mamaka pandava cheva kim akurvata sanjaya. Dharma kshetre, on the field of dharma. So that's the first verse of Bhagavad Gita, dharma. What's the last statement that Krishna gives, his most famous? Yes. And what does it begin with? What word? Dharma. Sarva dharman. Sarva dharman parityajya mam ekam sharanam. So then the acharyas say, look, dharma and dharma. Means what can you understand? What is this book about? Dharma. Right? It begins with the word dharma, it ends with the word dharma. Dharma, dharma. However, the essence of Bhagavad Gita itself has been located by our acharyas, by commentators, in four main verses. These four verses are found in which chapter of Bhagavad Gita? Anyone know?
Ten.
And which verse does it begin with?
Eight.
An easy way to remember is 108. Right? 108. 10:8. Chapter 10, text number 8. That's the first one. 8, 9, 10, and 11. These are the four essential verses of Bhagavad Gita. Now, I'm going to read just the verse in the translation for these four essential verses, so you can have a sense as to what these verses are. And then I'll talk about why, in particular, they chose these four verses. So, please repeat after me. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 If you know these verses, you can repeat after me. Aham sarvasya prabhavo.
Aham sarvasya prabhavo.
Matta sarvam pravartate.
Matta sarvam pravartate.
Iti matva bhajante mam.
Iti matva bhajante mam.
Buddha bhava samanvita.
Buddha bhava samanvita.
I am the source of all spiritual and material worlds. Everything emanates from me. The wise who perfectly know this engage in my devotional service and worship me with all their hearts. Next one. Machitta madgata prana.
Machitta madgata prana.
Bodhayanta parasparam.
Bodhayanta parasparam.
Kathayantascha mam nityam.
Kathayantascha mam nityam.
Tushyanti cha ramanti cha.
Tushyanti cha ramanti cha.
The thoughts of my pure devotees dwell in me. Their lives are fully devoted to my service. They derive great satisfaction and bliss from always enlightening one another and conversing about me. Text number 10. Tesham satatayuktanam.
Tesham satatayuktanam.
Bhajatam priti purvakam.
Bhajatam priti purvakam.
Tadami buddhi yogam tam.
Tadami buddhi yogam tam.
Yena mam upayanti te.
Yena mam upayanti te.
To those who are constantly devoted to serving me with love, I give the understanding by which they can come to me. Last one. Teshamevanukampartham.
Teshamevanukampartham.
Ahamagnyanajam tama.
Ahamagnyanajam tama.
Nashayamyatma bhavasto.
Nashayamyatma bhavasto.
Jnanadipena bhasvata.
Jnanadipena bhasvata.
To show them special mercy, I, dwelling in their hearts, destroy with the shining lamp of knowledge the darkness born of ignorance. Okay, so this is it. The essence of Bhagavad Gita in a nutshell. Now, we're going to be talking about these essential verses for the next couple days. But before we do that, we need to first try to understand why these verses in particular. Out of all so many famous verses present in Bhagavad Gita, Sarva Dharman Parityajya Deya Dharma Kshetriya Kuru Kshetriya, so many famous verses we know. Why these four verses in particular? And for this, we need to understand where they fit in Bhagavad Gita. So let's do a very quick overview of Bhagavad Gita to try to understand the logic of the conversation, not the philosophy. We're not going to focus so much on the philosophy, but the conversation. What's Krishna talking about? Why is he talking about it when he's talking about it? And where do these verses show up? Let's start. You know, people say the power of positive thinking. How you can accomplish so much by thinking positive. Let's start with a little bit of negative thinking, okay? And see its power also, the power of negative thinking. Okay? Think about the most difficult times in your life, the most difficult problems in your life. And not physical ones here, emotional ones. Conflicts. Emotional conflicts that cause pain. Where do those conflicts, where are they usually born? Where do they come from, our greatest emotional pains in this world? From family, right? From family or from people who are close to us. Now, this can be many forms, not just that we have horrible family members. Maybe we don't. But maybe like, even when a family member we love very much passes away. That's great pain. It comes from family. By having someone we love leave us. Or sometimes families don't get along. Two brothers will fight, and they'll have very bad taste, and they'll you know, divide up the inheritance, and they'll fight over little things, right? Over money, that can be a big issue. Sometimes the father in a family will become offended and kick the son or the daughter out of the house. So many things can go wrong. Or sometimes we just have tension, misunderstanding between husband and wife, between parents and children. But if you think about it, honestly, then our greatest pleasures in life and our greatest sufferings all come from family or close friends who are just like family. Our greatest happiness and our greatest suffering. You think of the best moments of your life. The birth of a child, your day of marriage, some moment where you did something. Suppose it was graduation. Right? But why was it such a wonderful moment? Because maybe your parents, your family were all there, proud of you, clapping for you. Whatever it might be. People who matter to us, they do something nice to us, it makes our day, it makes our year, our life. And people who matter to us do something bad to us, and it ruins us. Now, think of Arjuna's situation at the beginning of Bhagavad Gita. Here was someone who had spent his whole lifetime struggling with family matters, family issues. First, the death of his father. At a very small age, I don't know how old they were, 5, 6, 7, and being raised by their mother in a home where they were not really wanted. Their needs were taken care of, but they were always sidelined, pushed away, eventually threatened. There were attempts at their life starting the age of 10 or 11 years old. The same people who were their family members insulted their wife after marriage, tried to disrobe her in public. They tried to kill the entire family by building a house of lack. And on and on and on and on and on. And after a whole lifetime of struggle, spending 13 years in a forest, in secret, trying to avoid who? Family. Right? 13 years running away or being pushed away from family. Finally, everyone makes up their mind that we're just going to have to do something about this. Right? Battle is inevitable. This is between cousins, royal families, both sides. And they both gather armies. Every major empire or kingdom of the world is present there on the battlefield, making alliances on both sides. And everyone on that battlefield, they come from different parts of the world. They come different kingdoms, different strengths, different abilities, but they have one thing in common on that battlefield. What is that? They're all family. They're all family. All 840 million people are family. They're all tied by family relationships. Now think of that. No matter how bad of a situation we've been in our own lives, no matter how much trouble we've been in because of family, none of us, thank Krishna, have ever experienced anything like that. To be able to stand in front of millions of people who are all interrelated, many of them very close family, everyone with their weapons drawn, ready to kill each other. And when those conchas are blown, and Arjuna, he's the main fighter on the Pandava side. He's standing there. Bhagavad Gita has a beautiful description. On a beautiful chariot drawn by 5 white horses, with the flag of Hanuman flying, and Krishna himself, God himself, the chariot driver, with the world's best archer. And just picture that. That view, right? So beautiful, so ideal. Bhishma Dev, this was his vision of God. This is how he loved the Lord, was this picture of him on the battlefield with his hair flying in the wind and his body covered with the dust raised from the hooves of the animals in the battle and beads of sweat on his forehead and holding the reins of that battle, of the 5 horses with Arjuna in the back. This is the vision that Bhishma had. That ideal vision of the warrior and goddess charioteer. And that Arjun, he stands up in that battlefield after the conch shells are blown. Means the battle is ready to begin. And he says, Krishna, please take my chariot to the middle of both these armies so I can see who has come here to contend in this great trial of arms. And Krishna says, sure, your command, right? He's the chariot driver. And Senayor Ubhayor Madhye Ratham Sthapayam Achyuta. Achyuta, the infallible Lord, he never fails in his duty. He takes the chariot in the middle of the battlefield. And you know what he says? He says, Pashetan Kurun Iti. He looks at Arjun and he says, Arjun, hey look, all your family's here. Krishna, he's very cheeky. He can be. Right? This is what Prabhupada says in the purport. He's sort of half smiling, in a joking mood. But what a way to make a joke. Right? He knows exactly what's going through Arjun's head. He's standing here thinking, oh my God, I'm going to have to kill my fathers and uncles and fathers-in-law and grandfathers and teachers and... And Krishna's saying, hey, look, all your family's here. As like we would do at a reunion or a party. And Arjun, he just, at that point, he breaks down. He says, Gandivam samsrate hastat. He says, my dear Lord, my Gandiva is slipping from my hand. Tvakcha paridahyate. My skin is burning. My mind is reeling. My mouth is drying up. My body is trembling. My hair is standing on end. Roma harshascha jayate. Says all the hairs on. I don't know what to do. I'm totally confused. What am I supposed to do? My Gandiva is slipping from my hand. That same Gandiva that Arjun had vowed. Did, if anyone else had told him, oh Gandiva, oh Arjun, throw away your Gandiva, it's just a toy. People, you know, the Kshatriyas, they like to challenge each other like that. It's just a toy. Throw that toy away. What are you going to do? Arjun had vowed if anyone asked him to do that, he would kill that person. That's how much pride he has as a Kshatriya in his weapon. And today, he can't hold his own Gandiva. It's slipping from his own hand. And so he tells Krishna, Krishna, I can't fight. I can't do this. And what's Krishna's first argument to Arjun? When Arjun says this. How does Krishna try to motivate him for the first time? Anyone know in the Bhagavad Gita? His first try to get Arjun to get up and fight. Yeah, means what? How does he try to convince Arjun? He says, this is not what... Act like a man, he says. Right? Be a man. What's this? I can't fight, I'm feeling weak, my family's here. Look, you're a kshatriya, a warrior. When a warrior sees an enemy, it doesn't matter if it's your family, if it's your teacher, it doesn't matter who it is. You have to fight. Either you come back with your shield or on it. That's the mood of a kshatriya. Either you come back victorious or you come back dead. What's this weakness that's overcome you? He says, what are people going to say about you? All the girls are going to laugh at you. This is basically Krishna's argument in the beginning of the chapter. He says, your infamy will know no bounds. The great warriors will laugh at you. The women will all say, who is this weakling? You're Arjun. Think about it. Arjun, is he convinced?
No.
He tells Krishna flat out. He says, it doesn't matter. He says, the whole world can criticize me. Let them all come and kill me, unarmed and unresisting on this battlefield. Better that would happen than I have the blood of my relatives on my own hands. What's the use to me of this kingdom? And he gives Krishna some of the best anti-war arguments ever written. It's true. If you want a pacifist document, read the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Excellent, excellent arguments. He tells Krishna, first, says social upheaval. All the men are going to be dead. Do you know what that does to society? He says, the women will be without husbands, they'll be without fathers, they'll be without sons. The entire social fabric will go to hell. Because people become weak, they children at home don't have a father figure to look up to. We know this from our own society, right? What happens? So many studies done of what happens in a home where there's no father. There's a great loss to society at that point. And what wars do, we know this in our own country's experience, whether it's India or the United States, what can happen to a whole civilization after a war, the social mending that takes place. He says the people who make this happen, they go to hell, they stay there. And the forefathers fall from their positions in heaven as well, because all the Shraddha ceremonies are finished. He says it's immoral. We'll be covered by sin. He gives social arguments, ethical arguments, spiritual arguments. So many good arguments he gives. He says, I'm not going to do this. I can't do it. And yet, he can't walk away. He's saying, I'm not going to fight. And yet, he's still sitting on the chariot, not being able to walk away. Have you experienced this in your own life? I think we all have. Being in a situation where you can't get yourself to do it, but you can't get yourself to walk away either. I don't want to do this. And yet, it takes a lot of courage to turn around and say, forget it, get lost, I'm going. I can't make that decision. That was the situation Arjun was in. Saying, my mind is reeling. I think, no, maybe I should do it. No, maybe I should. Maybe I should do it. Maybe I shouldn't. And back and forth, back and forth. It's called Vyudhavikalpa. That the mind goes this way, that way, this way, that way, this way. So finally, he takes one very important step in chapter 2. Verse 7, he says, Karpanya dosho bhata swabhava prichami tvam dharma samudha cheta yachreyasyan nishchitam bruhitanme shishyasteham shadhimam tvam prapanyam. My dear Lord, I don't know what to do. I'm totally confused about my duty. Prichami tvam dharma. That's why I'm asking you, what is my dharma? Again, right? The same thing. Arjun's question, first question. What is my dharma? Prichami tvam dharma. Samudha cheta. Because I'm totally confused. Yachreyasyan nishchitam bruhitam. Tell me for certain what I should do. He's indecisive. He doesn't know what to do. Shishyasteham. I'm your disciple. Mam tvam prapannam. I've surrendered unto you. So Arjun begins the Gita by surrendering to Krishna. What's Krishna's last instruction in Bhagavad Gita? Surrender to me. Again, you see the logic here? It's a package. It's like a sandwich. Things are packaged nicely. Dharma, dharma. What is dharma? Surrender, beginning, prapannam, and sharanagati. Krishna says, come surrender to me. So same message. Arjun says, okay, I'm ready to surrender. And at that point, Krishna begins Bhagavad Gita. This is such a beautiful verse, 2:7, chapter 2, verse 7. If you ever find yourself in a situation where you're feeling really, really stuck, you're feeling indecisive, you don't know what to do, how to decide which way to go, recite this verse in a prayerful mood, and you'll be amazed. A solution always presents itself. Krishna always gives guidance. This has been my own experience. It's really, really a powerful verse. It was spoken by possibly the most desperate devotee at the most desperate time in his life. Can you think of a devotee who was more desperate than Arjun? He spoke it with his full heart. So it's a very special verse. It pushed Krishna to say the entire Bhagavad Gita. That's how powerful this verse is. So, if we ever find ourselves in that kind of situation, try reciting this verse with a little bit of oomph to it. When you really, really need help. Not when you're trying to decide, you know, which type of pasta to buy. when you really need it, right? When you're at that moment in life, right? Just try reciting the verse. Krishna will always help. Just like he did Arjun. Okay, so now we're going to move a little bit faster. This is the scene, okay? Setting of the scene. Krishna, first thing he does, he says, look, you're a fool. He says, Ashochanan Vashochastam Pragnyavadangsha. He's being sarcastic. Krishna's good at sarcasm. At first time, he did it. And then again, chapter 2, verse 11, he says, ah, you're so smart, aren't you, Arjun? You think you're so smart. You know it all. Great arguments. But do you know the basics? What's the difference between a living person and a dead one? What's the difference? Do you know the nature of the soul? So chapter 2, he gives the science of the Atma, the science of the soul. At the end of chapter 2, Krishna says, okay, now that you've understood the science of the soul, he presents Buddhi Yoga, or acting with intelligence. He says, you should, with this knowledge, you should act with this knowledge. What is matter and what is spirit? That we are the spirit soul. That we can't actually be killed. No one can die. We're all equal. The Atma in everyone is the same. We're all spiritual. And all the material, physical body doesn't matter. So, after Krishna gives this whole knowledge of the soul, Arjuna asks a very logical question at this point. That if you think about it, very reasonable question. He says, look, if you've just said that we're not the bodies, we're the spirit souls, what matters is the soul, not the body, then clearly all this kingdom I'm fighting for doesn't matter, right? If what matters is the soul, why are you forcing me to fight for something that's clearly related to the body? Means kingdom, family, relatives, that's what I'm going to get by fighting, right? I'm going to be the ruler of the world. So that doesn't matter. You should see the soul, and therefore I should go take sannyas maybe. I should become an ascetic. So tell me, Krishna, I'm very confused by your equivocal instructions. Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita, he's no pushover. He doesn't take anything lying down. He's very intelligent, and he asks all the right questions at the right times. He'll never give up until he fully understands something. And so he says, Krishna, I'm confused by your equivocal instructions. You seem to be saying two things at the same time. Please explain. So Krishna's answer, what's more important, knowledge or work? Right? He says, should I renounce everything or should I work? And Krishna says, you got to do both. Right? He says, you work, but you renounce the fruits of your work. And this is Krishna's famous synthesis. He says, renunciation and work, both are necessary. They're not opposites. You have to work, but renounce the fruits. Okay, so Arjuna's fine. Then Krishna goes on chapter 4. He says, Arjuna's understood. Krishna's saying, okay, he's giving a little background about this knowledge. He says, actually, I told the same thing to the sun god, Vivaswan, millions of years ago. And it got passed down over time. But it was lost, the knowledge. So I'm telling you again, now. And Arjuna stops Krishna right there immediately. Krishna barely says this, three verses, and he stops and he says, this isn't clear to me. We're both the same age, but you spoke this 2 million years ago to Vivaswan, the sun god. This doesn't make any sense. Krishna then answers. For the first time in Bhagavad Gita, in chapter 4, Krishna talks about himself. For the first time. So far he's been talking about the Atma, about duty, about dharma. It's all about Arjuna and who he is and what he should do. For the first time Krishna says, okay, maybe let me point out, there's a big difference between me and you. He says, Bahuni me vyatitani, janmani tavacharjuna. Both of us have been through many births, but I remember all of them and you don't. Ajopisan avyayatma. He says, I'm eternal. My body never is destroyed, unlike your body. And he says those verses which everyone knows. Yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharat. And I come back over and over again. Back and forth. Therefore, he says, the true secret of success is you should know me. Come to know me. This transcendental knowledge, he says, of me is that which will take you across this ocean of misery by this knowledge. And Krishna is so happy at the end of chapter 4. The last verse of chapter 4, Krishna says, so Arjuna, I've explained everything to you. Now, uttishta uttishta, stand up and fight. End of chapter 4. And beginning of chapter 5, what does Arjuna say? No, Krishna, I'm still confused. It's actually, we don't tend to read across chapters. We stop at the end of a chapter, then we go to the next chapter, and now a new chapter is beginning. But if you look at the juxtaposition, it's actually very interesting. Just the previous verse, Krishna means he's so optimistic, and Krishna tries this several times in Gita. He thinks, now maybe Arjuna is convinced. At the end of chapter 2, he says, now stand up and fight. And then Arjuna is confused. He asks another question. End of chapter 4, Krishna says, okay, Arjuna, it's all clear. I'm God, you're the servant, right? I'm eternal, you're temporary. And Krishna make his position clear. Now I'm telling you, stand up and fight. Ready? And Arjun says, no, I'm still confused. Can you repeat that again? Same question he asked in chapter 3. He says, can you tell me again? You want me to become a pundit and learn, read lots of books, gain knowledge, take sannyas? This time he specifically uses the word sannyasa. Does you want me to take sannyas? Or you want me to stand here and fight? I'm still confused. So Krishna goes on and he defines what a real sannyasi is. A true sannyasi is not someone who doesn't do any work, or who doesn't light any fire. But he says someone who works without attachment. Now, chapter 6. Krishna explains Dhyana Yoga now. So, Jnana Yoga is finished. Now he's explaining the yoga of meditation. And beautiful description there. You should sit with your head and neck erect in a straight line, stare at the tip of your nose, eyes half closed, sitting in yoga posture, completely celibate, in a place that's not too high, not too low, and most importantly, control your mind. Right? Focus it, he says, on what? On me, he says very clearly. Focus your mind on me. Arjun hears all of this, and what does he say? No, can't do this again. Look at how strong Arjun is. And thanks to him, we have the Bhagavad Gita. That all the doubts that we might raise, Arjun is asking on our behalf. He's a pure devotee of the Lord. He's already surrendered in verse number 7. He says, Prapanna, I've surrendered to you. But he raises all these doubts for our benefit. And he's saying, look, Krishna, I can't do this. It's too difficult. Chanchalam himana Krishna. Pramati balavadrita. The mind is so difficult to control. It's so fickle. I can't do this. And Krishna, does he back down? No, he doesn't back down. What does he say? He says, you can do it, Arjun. You can do it. By practice and by detachment. And same thing a piano teacher would tell their student. The student comes and says, this is too difficult. He says, no, you can do it just by practice. Just need to practice more. So does Arjun accept that and go on? No. What does Arjun say? He's still not convinced, right? He's saying, okay, what if you don't succeed? This is when he asks Arjun the question, Krishna the question. What happens to the unsuccessful yogi? Right? He's still thinking himself, saying, sure, you say practice and detachment, but what if I don't make it by the end of this life? What happens to me then? And Krishna says, then he becomes a little softer. Krishna says, don't worry, Arjun. This is nothing bad will happen. You'll not be lost. Arjun is really worried. He says, is that person completely lost, like a riven cloud? He says. Krishna says, no, there's no loss, no problem. You'll take your birth again in a family of devotees, or in a very well-to-do family, or a pure Brahman family, and you'll continue from where you leave off. Okay, so like this, it goes on. 7, 8, chapter 9, at the beginning, something special happens. Krishna's talked about karma yoga, he's talked about jnana yoga, he's talked about dhyana yoga, he's talked about himself, revealed who he is in chapter 7, chapter 8. But chapter 9, he begins with a special promise. He says, now, Arjun, I'm going to tell you that which is the most secret. And for the first time, Krishna is offering Arjun the greatest secret. So immediately we know chapter 9 is something special. And of course we know it's special because chapter 9 for the first time has a description of bhakti yoga. So far only hints, but now bhakti yoga. And Krishna prefaces it by saying, sarva guhyata, this is the most secret thing I'm going to tell you. At the beginning of chapter 9, well, chapter 9 ends with this very famous verse. You know this verse? Manmana bhava mad bhakto madhyaji mam namaskuru. So, think of me, become my devotee, offer your homage unto me. This is the big secret. One of the few verses Krishna repeats verbatim, or almost, and there's a little bit of a difference. In 1866, Krishna repeats the verse. Same thing, he says, Man mana bhava man pukto, think of me. Because, and there also he says, I'm telling you my greatest secret. Chapter 9 is big. So Krishna, at the end of Bhagavad Gita, he's worried. What if in chapter 9, Arjun missed what the greatest secret was? What if he heard the whole chapter and he thought it was something else? There's a lot of verses, what, 29 verses, something like that, in chapter 9? What if he missed it? So Krishna, at the end of Gita, he's very concerned. And he says, let me repeat that verse I said, just so I know he knows. I can make sure he got the right verse, which is the most secret. But at the beginning of chapter 9, Krishna says something very confusing to Arjun. He says, my dear Arjun, everything is in me. But actually, everything is not in me. I'm in everything. But actually, I'm not in anything. I'm beyond it. He says, very confusing. He says, everything is in me, and I'm in everything. So any person would wonder about this. Right? Typically, these two things can't occur at the same time. A baby is in the mother's womb, right? But to then say that the mother is in the baby's womb is confusing, right? Either the mother's inside the baby or the baby's inside the mother. How can you get both at the same time? Krishna's saying, everything is in me, in my body, saying, I'm in everything. In every body, he says, I'm present. So Arjun asks about this in chapter 10. He says, Krishna, how can I know you? How can I understand you? Chapter 10, Krishna explains how he is in everything. Chapter 11, Krishna explains how everything is in him. You get both sides of the equation. Chapter 10, we know is famous. Krishna gives every good category in this world. And he says how of immovable things, I am the Himalayas. Of mountains, I am Mount Sumeru. Of bodies of water, I am the ocean. Of fish, I am the shark. He says, of silent things, I am the greatest secret. Of cheaters, I am gambling. Of all kinds of things, he says, I'm the best in this, the best in that. I'm in everything, he says. And chapter 11, then he turns around. And he says, look, everything's in me. The whole universe is present in my body. Indra and the demigods are in my arms. The sun and the moon are my eyes. The mountains are my bones. The trees are my hair. My veins are the rivers. And he shows the entire universe present within his own body. So he proves his statement in chapter 9 of Bhagavad Gita. I am in everything, and everything is in me. This, at this juncture in chapter 10, is where these four essential verses of Bhagavad Gita come. At the beginning of chapter 10, Krishna begins the chapter by saying, Shrinu me paramam vacha. O Arjun, now listen again, paramam vacha, to my supreme words, my supreme instruction. So it's not that we're making this up. Oh, these are the most essential verses of Bhagavad Gita. Or some commentator made this up. Krishna is making it clear. He says, now listen to my supreme instruction. And the last four verses of that instruction are the ones we read. So this is how Krishna sets up the most essential verses of Bhagavad Gita. And after Arjun listens to these four verses of Bhagavad Gita, you know what he does? For the first time in Bhagavad Gita, Arjun responds not with a question, not with a doubt, not with a problem, but how?
Praise.
With praise, with awe and reverence. He says, Param Brahma, Param Dhamma, Pavitram Paramam Bhavan, Purusham Shashvatam Divyam, Adidevam Ajam Vibhum. He says, Ahustvam Rishaya Sarve, Devarshi Naradastata, Asito Devalo Vyasa, Swayam Jaiva Bravishime. He says, Param Brahma, you are the supreme Brahman. Param Dhamma, you're the supreme abode. Pavitram, the purest. Paramam Bhavan, the greatest you are. Purusham, the original person. Shashvatam, eternal. He's going on and on praising Krishna. And he says, Sarvam etadritam manye. I accept as truth everything you've said. Now, given what we've talked about so far, you hear the difference? You hear the difference in Arjun's tone? So far, has Arjun ever said, I accept as true everything you've said? No, quite the opposite. He's saying, this is not making sense. You please explain this more. I don't think I can do this, Krishna. Try, give me some other process. But after hearing these four verses, right after these four verses, Arjun goes, okay, I know, you're the supreme. And everything you've said is true. In fact, you're not even the first person to say this. Everyone, every authority in the world confirms this fact about you. His mood changes at that point in Bhagavad Gita after hearing Krishna's greatest instruction. And our mood should change also. This is why these four verses are so powerful in Bhagavad Gita. If they had the ability to lift Arjun, a person who had more problems than any one of us can even imagine, if it had the potential to lift Arjun out of his depression, out of his confusion, out of his fear, and make him joyful, those verses are just bubbling with happiness. Arjun's repeating himself, Param Brahma, Param Dhamma, Pavitram, Paramam, Bhavan. Again and again he's saying, Param, 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 Param. And he's so happy. If it has the potential to lift Arjun to that state, then any serious reader of Bhagavad Gita who understands these four verses should have the same result. They have the same power for anyone. And that's why it's so important to understand the meaning of those four essential verses. So, this is sort of the introduction leading up to the essence of Bhagavad Gita, which we will discuss in the next 2 days now. These four verses, and just exactly what makes them so amazing in terms of content. Why did they have that effect on Arjun? And why should they have that effect on us? That's what we're going to look at in the next couple days. Any questions at this point about anything we've discussed so far? Any comments? The structure of Bhagavad Gita is very, very beautiful. Sometimes we see just the individual verse, which are so deep in themselves. For each verse you could talk for hours. But getting the big picture is actually really amazing. Because you see the dynamic between Krishna and Arjun. You see how natural it is between a guru and a disciple, between a friend and a friend, between God and a devotee. Such a natural exchange, a conversation. So personal in nature, back and forth. It really reveals a lot to see that exchange. And then you can obviously go into the specific verses. But the big picture is important. Yes?
Just like you explained in Ramayana, that first verse, Valmiki Muni uttered, and then he said the whole thing about Ramayana, kind of. Could you please explain how the first verse of Bhagavad Gita relates to the whole Bhagavad Gita?
Excuse me. Yeah, that's a good question. Other than this emphasis on the word dharma, I haven't heard of any commentaries in which every word is reinterpreted to include the meaning of the entire Gita. Usually there's two points made. Number one, that the word dharma is essential, right? That this sort of indicates the purport of the entire text. The meaning is all present in that one word. The second point that's often made is regarding the last line of that verse, which was Dhritarashtra's question, Kim akurvata sanjaya? Akurvata means act. What did they do? What did they do? And so, again, it's pointed out that the Bhagavad Gita is primarily concerned with action. What did they do? These two things, dharma and karma, is what the Bhagavad Gita is talking about. What is the ultimate dharma? What is the ultimate karma that we should be doing? And you see, these two words are the most frequently used in Bhagavad Gita. Even in later on, chapter 8, right, Krishna is saying, Yat karoshi, yad asnasi, yad juhosi, dada. Whatever you do, do that as an offering to me. So Gita is all about action. Whether it's action in, as a warrior or it's action to serve God. But clearly Krishna wants Arjuna to act because he's sitting there on a battlefield. There's no question of turning around. So these are the two things that are usually said that are extracted from the verse first. Dharma in the first line and karma in the last line. Kim akurvata. Yes?
Arjuna's understanding of Krishna before Bhagavad Gita?
Yeah, good question. What was Arjuna's understanding of Krishna before Bhagavad Gita? They had an intimate relationship as a friend. Arjuna's understanding of Krishna was as equals, as a friend would treat another friend. And in fact, Krishna says this in chapter 4. He says, I'm telling you this Bhagavad Gita. Bhaktosime sakha cheti rahasyam hi tadottamam. I'm taking the trouble to tell you this because you're my bhakta, my devotee, and also my sakha, my friend. Rahasyam, therefore I'm telling you this secret. So, Prabhupada explains in the purport in chapter 2 that when Arjun says that verse in verse number 7 in chapter 2, I don't know what to do, now I'm your disciple. At that point, their relationship turns from one of friendship to one of formal relationship of guru and disciple. As long as the relationship was one of friendship, Krishna couldn't say too much. His arguments in chapter 1 and beginning of chapter 2 are very friendly. He's using joking manner, humor. He's sort of jabbing him and saying, you know, come on, be a man, get up, fight. In the way that a friend would do it. But a friend, you can't really lecture at someone, you say. You know, you treat him as an equal. So when Arjun changes that relationship by accepting Krishna as guru, then Krishna, he gives up all the joking business. And he says, okay, the guru's first duty, Prabhupada explains, is to chastise the disciple. This is the meaning of guru. Guru means heavy. And he has to be heavy. First thing he has to do is set him straight, to wake him up, slap him. He says, what are you doing? So that's immediately he does. Verse 11, he says, you think you're so learned, but actually you don't know the basics yet. So from friendship to one of guru and disciple relationship. And at the end, it ends up in a relationship of a pure devotee, a bhakta, with the Supreme Lord. Arjun, he surrenders to the Lord completely. He says, my Lord, I'm ready to do exactly as you say. You're my Lord, you're my master. So he never gave up his relationship of friendship, just temporarily made it more formal, put it on hold for the purpose of the Gita. Yes?
What was the initiate name of Arjuna after the initiation?
As far as we know in the Gita, Krishna doesn't give him a new name in terms of initiation. The initiation that occurs is basically a conveyance of spiritual knowledge. That's the essence of Diksha anyway, is the conveyance of spiritual knowledge. So Arjun doesn't receive a new name at this point. Krishna already in Gita, he calls him by many names. He says Mahabaho, he tells him. He says Savyasachin, he calls him. Savyasachin, you know this name? It's a nice name. It means ambidextrous. Savyasachi means he who could shoot arrows with both hands. It's a big advantage. If you're shooting arrows, anyone who does archery here? Anyone? It's actually
I tried it.
It's one of the heaviest workouts for your shoulders. It's very difficult to do. If you don't know how to do it properly, you can actually cause a lot of pain and damage. It's very difficult to pull the bow. For it to be tight enough to actually shoot the arrow anyway, not the kid's type, you know, but some to actually get it to some distance and accuracy, it has to be very tight and very heavy as a bow. And so imagine doing this on a battlefield for 8 hours a day. You're going to get tired, right? So if you can move the bow from this hand and shoot this way, then you've got twice the stamina immediately. So that's why he was savyasachi, he was ambidextrous. So Krishna calls him by many wonderful names, and Arjun does the same thing. He calls Krishna by many names. Yes, please.
If Arjun wasn't ready to follow the instructions that Krishna was going to give, why in 2.7 he says, "I'm your disciple, please instruct me"?
Because he's convinced that Krishna is the best person to help him, and he's convinced that Krishna's advice is the best thing for him. But he still doesn't have the courage to actually follow through with that advice. So this is exactly what happens at the moment of Diksha. Diksha we call initiation. Initiation in English means?
Beginning.
The beginning. Diksha means that a disciple thinks in the following way. My dear Lord, I know that the only thing that will make me happy in this life is your service. My dear spiritual master, I know that following your instructions is the best thing for me, and you are my well-wisher. Please instruct me. But I still have some material desires. I know this is the best for me, but I still can't get myself to do it. That's the position of Diksha. Right? That's the moment of Diksha, where you're convinced of this point internally, but you don't have the strength to fully go through with it, to execute it. And so that was exactly the position that Arjun was in. He knew it was good for him, but not quite ready to go the full 9 yards. And we think of our own times, if you've received Diksha already. We stand in front of the Guru and we make vows, we make promises to follow certain rules, knowing very well that we may not be able to do everything that the Guru asked me to do immediately, right? Which is fully surrender to Krishna. I'm trying, right? Okay, just chant your 16 rounds. Follow the four regulative principles. Do at least that much. Yes, okay, that much I will do. Right? That's the bare minimum. Then it's a state of progress from there. Step by step by step, you get better and better. So you see that progress with Arjun. Bare minimum, he says, Krishna, you instruct me. I'll do what you say. But I still need to be convinced. It'll still take me a little time. And you see, as the Gita progresses, Arjun becomes more and more and more convinced as he goes on. Yes?
Yeah, you just said that Arjuna's problem was lack of courage, why he didn't follow immediately. I'm wondering if it was really so much lack of courage, or was it legitimate lack of understanding, which can affect your courage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, lack of understanding also. This is why spiritual knowledge is so important, because those issues become clarified. One's faith increases. These things go together, right?
Yeah.
The development of faith and the giving of spiritual knowledge. Mm-hmm. Both have to go together. Mm-hmm. And as the knowledge comes and we see, hey, what this person is saying is actually reasonable, and I tried a little bit and it works well, our faith increases.
Mm-hmm.
And as our faith increases, our ability to follow those instructions and to receive more, they increase even more. Right? So Guru starts off by chanting, saying, chant your 16 rounds. So we try to follow that. It works, right? Life is better. It's happening. Things are moving along. Next, the Guru says, okay, now why don't you spend a little more time, do a little more sacrifice for Krishna? Okay, I'll try. But what about my material life? What about my job? What about my family? It's okay, Krishna will take care. So we try it out. Oh, it's amazing. Krishna takes care. I did a little more for him. Krishna took care. Right? Then the Guru gives even a more difficult instruction. And we think, okay, now I don't know if I can do that, but we try again. Right? So it's like raising the bar. Right? They raise the bar, and see how far can you jump, like that. and sort of training us, increasing faith, giving knowledge, increasing faith, giving knowledge. Like that.
So how does that one is a link to the renunciation without fruits of work, you know?
Hmm. As our faith increases, then our ability to renounce also increases. Okay? So these things, again, jnana, vairagya, these things go hand in hand. Jnana, vairagya. Jnana means the knowledge, and vairagya means the ability to apply that knowledge. Suppose the spiritual master says that the best thing for you to do is to give up cigarettes, to give up smoking. So you've gotten that knowledge. But the ability to apply that knowledge, to actually give them up, that's vairagya. That's vairagya. So knowledge and its application. Knowledge and its application. These two things, they go together. Just an accumulation of knowledge, that makes a scholar, right? But not necessarily the best practitioner. And just renunciation without knowledge, what happens? That's if you have the knowledge. If you have the knowledge without renunciation, it becomes mental speculation. But if you practice renunciation without the proper knowledge, your renunciation will not last. It's called markata vairagya. Right? It the renunciation of a monkey. It doesn't last. Because you don't have any grounding. Suppose I say, tomorrow I'm going to go to the Himalayas. Right? And I'm going to just give up the world. Within a few days, I'll be turning around and on a flight back home. Why? Because I don't have the conviction, the knowledge, the faith inside that's necessary to follow through with that. It's impossible. So so these two things have to go. If renunciation is premature, without the appropriate knowledge, then it can actually be very damaging. And this is Krishna's telling this to Arjuna also. Arjuna wants to leave and go to the forest. Krishna's saying no. You fulfill your duty. When you come out the other end, you'll be ready to be renounced. And so at the end of the Mahabharata, they are, the five Pandavas, after fighting the whole battle, getting the throne, then they go, okay, had enough. Right? At that point, if Arjuna had turned around and gone away, all the ghosts of the past would have followed him. Weren't they 13 years in the forest already? Right? Living in the forest? What happened? Were they peaceful? Were they renounced? No, they were making alliances for the great battle to come. Right? That was necessary. So Krishna is saying, no, you do your work with detachment. When the time comes, you can go. Right? When the time comes, you can go. And that's what they did. Yes?
Guruji, in the Gita, there's Krishna says to Arjuna that, you know, everyone works according to one's nature. How one can find out what his nature is and how to apply that one's own life.
Yeah, that's a big question. How to work according to your nature? How to find out what your nature is? One thing that's important to remember at the outset: finding your nature is not a one-time thing. Right? One's nature changes throughout one's life, right? In the sense that we're talking about nature now. Ultimate nature, a servant of Krishna, doesn't change. Right? But if we're talking, I'm guessing that your question has to do with more practical matters,
yes,
right? Worldly matters.
Yes.
How do you know what type of work I should do, what type of service I should do, that kind of thing. And that'll change through our whole life. This is what's the meaning of Varnashrama. At every stage of life, our nature will change, therefore the dharma we're supposed to do will also change. So discovering your dharma is an ongoing process. And for that we need two people's help. We need the help of our spiritual master who keeps us focused very clearly on the ultimate dharma. Whatever you might be doing now, he says, okay, that's good, right? But don't lose your focus. Right? Keep your eyes set on your target. So he's crucial, absolutely. Second person's help we need is an ashram guru. Someone who can guide us in the particular ashrama, in the particular stage of life in which we're present, and from whom we can get advice. So if we're planning to enter Grihastha ashram, we should seek out people who are within that ashram, who have experience, who have been through it, and can give us some advice. And who know us well too, and can say, you know, I think you should do it this way, or maybe you should look for someone like that, or, you know, who can help us work through that. If we've been through married life, kids are grown up, we should be looking at Vanaprastha ashram. Say, who can help me through this particular ashram? How do I extract myself from the day-to-day micromanagement of the family? So these two things are necessary. Is the spiritual master and the ashram master, the ashram guru, who can help us, both of these together, can help us figure out what our current dharma is without losing focus on the paro dharma, on the ultimate dharma. And then we try. Right? And then we try. This is a trial and error is the best way to learn. We try something, we see, okay, how are the Lord's devotees appreciating it or not appreciating it? Is my spiritual master pleased? Is this what Krishna wants? Krishna will give us some inspiration in the heart. He'll give us confirmation or not. Right? And then we say, oh, this is working nicely. I should go on with it. One thing my spiritual master, Hanumat Beshak Maharaj, he said recently in an email, he said, as soon as we become perfect in a service, we should give it to someone else. Think about that. As soon as we become perfect in a service, we should give it to someone else. It means it's a very powerful message. The idea here is that we don't become attached. That, oh, I've done this well. What happens? We do some service nicely, and it becomes our kingdom. Right? How dare anyone do this? Because I do it, right? I make the best garlands for Krishna. How could you come? And you're doing some new system? The deities have always liked my garlands. I put the flowers in patterns of two, and you're doing it in three. That's not nice. Right? So obviously we're good. This is why someone is coming to learn from us, to help us. But our duty then is to pass it on. The fact that we have succeeded in the service means that now our next duty is there, which is to engage someone else. This is the whole process of bhakti. Become perfect yourself and then engage someone else. And we become perfect ourselves and then we hoard it and say it's mine, then what are we doing? This is ahankara. This is labha, pratishtha, puja, these anarthas. These unwanted things of arrogance and pride that come up in the practice of bhakti. I'm the best at this. I'm going to do it for my whole time. How dare I give it up? And that's the biggest impediment also in moving on in our ashram. We get stuck to a particular service. We don't want to give it up. And therefore we don't change our ashram. But if we've been washing pots perfectly for the last 25 years, we should train someone. Right? Because by the time we become 60, it won't be an easy service for us to do. So better we train someone else, move it on. In this way, Krishna's service goes on nicely. Sorry, there was a hand here. Yeah.
Probably like in chapter 10, Krishna says that I'm among the mountains, I'm Meru, among the man's ability, I'm intelligence, and so on. So he picks up all the best things of it. And does it mean that he's not the other one? But in reality, he's everything, right?
Yes.
So what is that...
Yeah, that's a good question. The question was, Krishna chooses the best things of every category in chapter 10, of immovable things, I'm Himalaya, and so on. So does he mean he's not the other things? He's just those things. And the answer is no, it doesn't mean that. See, the question that Krishna is trying to answer in chapter 10, Arjuna's question at the beginning was, tell me how I can know you, how I can remember you, he says. Because at the end of chapter 9, Krishna says, manmana, think of me. So Arjuna's question is, well, how do I think of you? How do I remember you? And Krishna says, oh, just look around. You can remember me in everything. So Krishna is giving us ways to remember him. It's not that he's not present elsewhere, but you remember Krishna by thinking of the best. Because Krishna is the best. Right? So whenever you see the best quality in anything, you remember Krishna. How wonderful anything is, you remember Krishna. So we shouldn't be stuck on the categories. In our own life, anytime we see any quality that's wonderful, we should think, ah, that is Krishna. We see another devotee who does their service very nicely. Right? Instead of becoming envious of that devotee, we think, there's Krishna. Right? Krishna has empowered this devotee. Where is this power coming from? The moral at the end of chapter 10, you remember what it is? Krishna says, yad yad vibhuti mat sattvam, shrimat urjitam evava, Tattadeva vagachatam mama tejosh sambhavam. He says, Arjun, don't get stuck on these particular categories. He says, I could go on forever. It's endless. He says, rather, think of it like this. Everything that's beautiful and everything that's wonderful, powerful in this creation is a spark of my splendor. So anywhere we see a good quality, in any human being, we should think, Krishna has given that quality. And we should do namaskar. This is so that way we don't feel envy. We think, wow, this is Krishna who's giving this quality in this person. Right? He's empowering this person. Now, okay, that person may not be using it for Krishna. This is unfortunate. But still, I can see Krishna present there. Krishna says, of cheaters, I'm gambling. Right? So you look at them. Okay, they're not using it for a good thing. But they're so good at what they do. So must be some ability that's coming from Krishna. Okay. Yes.
My question is a little bit basic, but there are so many copies of Bhagavad Gita written by different people, different authors. Why we should read Bhagavad Gita as it is?
Yeah, so many copies of Gita written by different authors. Why should we read Bhagavad Gita as it is? The reason we should read Bhagavad Gita as it is because anytime we're reading any book, we should read it as it is. Right? Any book you have, whether it's a piece of literature or Shakespeare's dramas or plays or whatever, we should approach it as it is. It means we should allow that book to speak for itself. We should not immediately offer our own interpretation. And just like if you're reading a nice play by Hamlet, Shakespeare, a Hamlet play. So you read the play with an open mind and hear what it has to say. We don't offer our own twisted interpretation immediately and try to change it. So this is just a basic principle of reading. Any book we read, we should read as it is. Allow that text to speak for itself. That's the basic principle. Now, in this particular Bhagavad Gita, Srila Prabhupada has specifically made a point at the beginning in the introduction that his endeavor in this Gita is to allow Krishna's voice to speak for itself, to emerge clearly without using the Gita for a political agenda, some cultural agenda, national agenda, social agenda, whatever it might be. Using the Gita for Krishna's own agenda. And what was Krishna's agenda? He says, to change Arjun's life, to transform him, and get him to do what he wants to do. Right? So that's Krishna's agenda. That should be the agenda of any Bhagavad Gita that's presented. Is to hear Krishna's words so we can be convinced to do what Krishna's asking us to do. So any Bhagavad Gita that presents that is as it is. And Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita is presenting it like that. You find so many different Gitas out there. Some are written for a nationalistic purpose. Some are written because they have a particular philosophy that they're promoting. Everywhere in the Gita, every chapter you read, Krishna will come back to the same point. He'll say, ultimately, he says, become my devotee. It's all about me. When he talks about Dhyana Yoga, he tells Arjun the whole process and then he says, meditate on me. After the whole process, all the different yogas, he says, of all the yogis, the best is one who worships me as my devotee. When he talks about all the varieties of yajna in chapter 5, Krishna ends by saying, the goal of all yajnas, bhoktaram yajna tapasam, is me. He talks about a work in this world, karma, he says, yat karoshi yadashnasi, whatever you do, you should offer it to me. Any process that Krishna describes, he always ends that process. You can do this. Do it as an experiment. Pick up the Gita and take up any process that Krishna describes, any method in any chapter. Krishna will always end that process by saying, and do it for me. And yet, 99% of editions of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna's not there. Krishna is completely absent from the Gita. They'll bring out every message other than this basic message, think of Krishna. Or we don't have to be devotees of Krishna. It's just, it's the spirit within all of us that Krishna is asking us to look at. The voice of our own intellect. All those things are good, but why miss the main point? Why miss the main point? So that's the idea here. Is we allow the Gita to speak for itself. Actually, the Sanskrit of the Gita is very simple. It's not complicated. Sanskrit of Bhagavatam is very difficult. You have to be a great scholar in order to be able to understand just the meaning of the words in Bhagavatam. The dictionary doesn't help you half the time. It's so difficult. But Bhagavad Gita, the Sanskrit is actually very simple. Very, very simple, the way Krishna presents it. So you just read the words, understand what they mean, and read Bhagavad Gita as it is. That's Prabhupada's point here. He's not saying, my interpretation is the best. That's not what he's saying. If Prabhupada said, my interpretation is the best, then he would be no better than anyone else. This would not be Bhagavad Gita as it is. It would be Bhagavad Gita as Prabhupada says. Just like you have Bhagavad Gita as this person says, Bhagavad Gita as that person says. No. It's Prabhupada saying, you just read it like Krishna says. Understand Krishna in Krishna's way. Then if you don't like it, it's okay. Then you go on your own way. That's okay. You don't have to do it. But at least try to understand it the way the author wants to. That's all. Yes, in the back. Yeah, it's a good question. Is it okay to look at the worst and see Krishna there also? actually, we're going to talk more about this tomorrow. But just in brief, the best of the best is Krishna. He says that very clearly. The worst of the worst is not Krishna. It's the absence of Krishna. Okay? It's the complete absence of Krishna. It says, Krishna Surya Sama Maya Hoyandakar, Jaha Krishna Taha Nahi Maya Radhikar. It's like the sun. The brightest of all bright things is the sun. The darkest of all dark things is the absence of the sun. So the point is that you can remember Krishna in some way when you see the worst of the worst, but not by saying that's Krishna, but by saying, oh look, Krishna's absent, Krishna's gone. This is what maya means. In Bhagavatam, maya is defined as this. Krishna says, anything which appears to be absent from me, separate from me, anything, nothing can really be without Krishna. Right? Nothing can really be without Krishna. But anything where we separated 100% from Krishna, we remove Krishna from the picture because of our own forgetfulness, that's maya. And that's what we call darkness or andhakara. Actually, the fact of the matter is, the sun is always present. Right? Means there's really no time. We say at night the sun is not there. But that's not a fact. If the sun were really not there, you know what would happen? They say within 8 minutes, all life on earth would be dead. If the heat and the radiance from the sun were gone from the earth, we would be in a cold, cold, empty space. And we'd all be dead. The energy of the sun is still present, even though we may not be seeing the light of it, because we are on the wrong side of the earth. So the same way, Krishna is always there. He's always present. Therefore, a devotee can see Krishna in any circumstance. But when we see some quality which we think is very negative, very bad, then we understand, this is due to forgetfulness of Krishna. That someone has forgotten Krishna. Therefore, the situation has become like this. It's become so bad. So evil is the absence of God. It's not a substance in opposition to God.
But it does not exist by itself.
No. Exactly. It doesn't exist on itself. Just like a reflection has no existence outside the original object. The reflection of the sun, a reflection of a tree, may be completely upside down. But it's 100% dependent on the tree itself. So evil is completely upside down. It's described in the Bhagavatam that it's the back of God. It's completely upside down. The Lord doesn't like to see it at all. It's the absence of the Lord. It's trying to get away from the Lord. But even that cannot exist without him. We'll go into this more detail later on. Oh, sorry, you were first. Yes.
Last question.
Okay, last question. Oh yeah, my God, what time is it?
9:30. I have two questions together.
This always happens at the last question. The last question will be three. Okay, please.
So I'm so curious, why did Krishna choose this way to release Gita? And how did Krishna release 2 million years ago to the studio of Gita? How did that?
Yeah, to the sun god, it wasn't in a context of battle, as far as we know. I mean, we don't know much about that particular incident other than what Krishna says in one verse. So we have some idea as to when that might be because of the Vedic time periods given. But in terms of what happened at that point, we don't have too much information about it, as far as I know. So maybe some other shastras might have, I don't know. But as far as I know, there's not much information. As to the first part of your question, why does Krishna talk about release Gita like this to Arjuna? It's because if he can show that the message of the Gita works in the most difficult circumstance, then no one can say, I can't do it. Right? No one can say, well, Arjuna had an easy time, but I can't do it. Actually, people still say that. You know, in India, people still say, Arjun ke samne to Bhagwan the, mere samne Bhagwan ka hai, right? God was present standing right before Arjun, but God is not here, right? So I'm poor me, I can't do anything. Right? But also look at what Arjun was going through, right? Maybe you don't need God standing right in front of you. Our problems are very small compared to Arjun's problem. So Krishna, he gives it in the most difficult circumstance so that there's no excuses for anyone that, oh, I cannot do it. Arjun's had an easy life. That's why he could do it. That's one reason. Second reason is because the deepest spiritual hankering in a human being comes in times of difficulty. Right? This is just a fact. Again, something we'll talk about more next time. We'll talk about this whole suffering, evil problem more tomorrow. But the greatest soul-searching that people do is times of suffering. You think about how people come to God in any religion of the world is when they're suffering, when they're in a difficult position. So it's natural that Krishna should speak it here. If he spoke it to someone who was a king relaxed in his own kingdom, eating a bunch of grapes and having 3 glasses of wine at the same time and sort of relaxing, then the message would have no impact. Even after Krishna gave the whole Gita, the person will still be like, I don't know if I'm convinced. Tell me more, right? That's just useless speculation. Krishna was not interested in that. He gave it to someone who really showed the need for it. And that's someone who is in a state of desperation. You look at so many devotees, they come to Krishna when life is difficult. They come, when they reach their greatest moment of desperation, that's when Krishna changes their life. They come to Krishna. And the same thing happened to Arjuna. He became a Hare Krishna at the most difficult period of his life. Thank you all very much for your attention.